for generating Genus 2 curves for cryptography. And this is going to be partially talking about joint work with several different people. So some joint work with Eyal Gorin. This is on bounds, which I'll talk about in a little while. And then some joint work with Kirsten Eisentrager, who's here, on the Chinese remainder algorithm for generating Genus 2 curves, and some joint work with David Freeman, largely on computing endomorphism rings. Okay, so since I'm going to talk about, despite the fact that Renata already gave us a whole hour-long lecture about arithmetic of Jacobians of hyperelliptic curves of various natures, I'm going to repeat just a little bit. Maybe mine should have been before hers. I'm going to actually talk just a little bit about the imaginary, what she called the imaginary case. Okay, so for us, throughout this talk, P is going to be a large prime. So, or at least for the first part of this talk, a large prime that is of probably of cryptographic size. So in particular, P is not 2, and it's also not a very small prime. And so if we want to write the equation for a genus 2 curve, we know that a hyperelliptic model can be found, and we can write an affine model for the curve, y squared equals f of x. Now, so if we want genus 2, the genus will in general be, the degree of this will in general be either 2g plus 1 or 2g plus 2. So we're talking about f, which has either degree 5 or 6. So in Renata's talk, she was focusing on the case where the degree would be 6, where you have 2 points at infinity. And just for the purpose of illustration, I'm going to focus on what the arithmetic looks like for if the degree is 5. So since we're here talking about cryptography, we're thinking of doing eventually some kind of discrete log-based crypto system in a group. So what's the group? Well, you saw yesterday the picture of the group law for elliptic curves, seen probably a zillion times. The idea that you take 2 points on an elliptic curve, and you know, you pass a line through them, and you find, since the elliptic curve is defined by a cubic, you find another point of intersection, and that's a group law. Well, so let's revise this picture a little bit for the genus 2 situation. So over the reals, I realize this is not a valid thing to do over a finite field, but if you draw, once again, an analogy with the elliptic curve picture, if you draw a picture of the hyperelliptic curve where this has degree 5, so just think about what would happen if you tried to make a group structure here by just taking 2 points. And you know, something like this, imagine if you just tried to pass a line through. So that wouldn't work very well. You see 5 points of intersection, you say, oh, well, what's going on here? This doesn't look like a very good group. Okay, so that's just a little motivation for introducing the group that we want to use in cryptography, which is the Jacobian of the curve. So if this is the curve C, the fundamental object that we want to talk about, but which is intertwined with this curve, is the Jacobian of a curve. Okay, so the only definition the only definition of the Jacobian that makes sense in finite characteristic is what Renata mentioned, which is to think of the group which is actually the divisor class group of the curve. So what we want to do is look at all degree 0 divisors on the curve modulo some equivalence relation, which is going to be modulo principal divisors. Okay, so for those of you that don't know what this means, this div 0 of C, this is just the collection of formal sums of multiples of points on the curve. So just write some integer multiples of bunches of points, pi, are on C, and such that the degree of this divisor, which is the sum of these AIs, is equal to zero. Okay, now this collection, these are the degree zero divisors, and now we want to go modulo principal equivalence, which says that two divisors are equivalent if their difference is the divisor of a function, the divisor of zeros and poles of a function. Okay, so just as an example, if you're not familiar with this, I mean, just you could write down any old degree zero divisor, like something like this. So just as long as I think that 3 minus 4 plus 1 is 0. So any kind of degree zero divisor like that. But the nice thing about hyperelliptic curves is that we actually have a very nice reduced form for the representatives of the equivalence classes. So for hyperelliptic curves, I'll just write this up here, it follows from, well, first you can write what's called a semi-reduced divisor, which basically means that if you had a point P1 in your divisor and you also had its reflection over the y-axis, over the x-axis, that you could remove the reflected point from the expression for the divisor by using the divisor of the vertical line that passes through those points. So that's called semi-reduced. But it follows from the Riemann-Roch theorem that you can actually write the reduced representative as in the following form, P1 plus PG, where G is the genus, minus G times the point at infinity. So again, this is assuming this imaginary case where we have one point at infinity. And so in our case, that just means that all our elements of the Jacobian can just be thought of as pairs of points on the curve. So now our group law chances look a little bit better, because if we go back over to this picture and we pick pairs of points, so this is P1, P2, and let's see if I can cheat a little and draw a cubic here that this pink thing is supposed to be a cubic equation. This would be the way that you would add, see, I had to draw the cubic first, because otherwise if I drew the 4 points, I probably wouldn't be able to pass the cubic through them very well. But so if you had two pairs of points, P1 plus P1, P2, and call it Q1, Q2, those are two reduced representatives for two divisor classes. And the way that you add them and get another reduced representative is that you could formally add them, and then you would have the 4 of these. That would be your sum. And then the way to transform that into a reduced representative is to notice that, oh, there's a function passing through these 6 points, and so these 4 points are basically the opposite of these 2 points over here. So that's the kind of the group law that we're using here. And actually, if you use the terminology that Renata was using, which is that you're actually looking at the you're looking at pick zero, the divisor class is thought of as kind of like an ideal class group in the function field. The actual group law that we use in practice to implement in cryptography was written down by Cantor, and it's just an absolute analog of the composition of binary quadratic forms that was proposed by Gauss. So you basically just take the Gauss's recipe and you do the analog in the function field setting, and you get Cantor's algorithm for composing elements on the Jacobian, and then what you can do is you can actually show that that's equivalent to this geometric picture here, which is known to be the group law for the Jacobian genus 2 curves. Okay, so that's what the groups in question here are these Jacobians of genus 2 curves. So as long as the hyperelliptic discrete logarithm problem is hard, we could potentially use these groups for cryptography. So there's a couple of things we would like to know. First, we'd like to know what is the size of these groups. If we start out with a curve over a finite field, so let's start out with trace of Frobenius here, which is going to be in the sum of pi with all of its conjugates. And this is actually known to be by the Hasse-Wey bound that Igor mentioned yesterday. So this is somewhere in the interval p plus 1 plus 2g times the square root of p between p plus 1 plus 2g times the square root of p and p plus 1 minus 2g times the square root of p. So p here is less than or equal to p plus 1. And then the other question. No, this is, I'm just talking about over the okay. finite field okay. Fp. Now we also want to know how many points does it have over Fp squared, and there we need a p squared. So this is going to be p squared minus, and here we just have the sum of the pi I squareds. And so if you look at, I mean, using the same Hasse-Wey formula here, we have this is roughly p plus 1 plus 2g times the square root of, oops, the square root of p squared, which is p. Okay, so from this, the thing that's great about curves over finite fields is that once you know that a certain number of pieces of information, that is the number of points on the curve over the finite field that it's defined over, and the g extension fields of that curve, then you know the entire zeta function, so you know the number of points on the curve over all extension fields. And in particular, you know its zeta function, so you know what its isogeny class is. And this is also enough to determine what the number of points on the Jacobian is, so it's over Fp. So this is the product from I equals 1 to g, which in this case is 4. And you might be thinking, okay, this looks like two equations and four unknowns. How come you know these pi i's already? But actually, these pi i's come in conjugate pairs, and they have the property that pi I times pi I bar is equal to p. So it's really just two equations, two unknowns here, and that gives you enough information to know what the number of points on the Jacobian is. Okay, so you can actually write this. Let's give this a name. This is n1, and this is n2. Then this, the number of points on the Jacobian is actually n1 squared plus n2 over 2 minus p. Okay, so if you look at the size of this, n1 is roughly the size of p plus or minus some small multiple of square root of p. n2 is roughly the size of p squared plus or minus some multiple of p. Sorry, there's square root of p. So this is roughly of size p squared plus or minus to the 3/2. So that's the size of the group that we're looking at here for cryptography. Okay, so the next question you might ask is, so given a curve, can you actually find out how many points it has on it? Okay, and so unfortunately, for our purposes, the answer is basically no. So p is a large prime here, and what you would need to do to find out the number of points or the isogeny class would be to be able to compute these pi i's. So as many of you know that in the elliptic curve case, we have the polynomial time algorithm for point counting of René Scoff and then zillions of extensions and improvements to that. And those rely on being able to compute the action of pi I on L torsion of the elliptic curves. The L torsion of an elliptic curve is very well understood, and its points can be found by looking for roots of the division polynomials, and so everything is in really good shape. Unfortunately, for genus 2, that is not the case in our situation, and so that's kind of the first open problem that I'd like to point to which I think is a really significant open problem in this area, is that for genus 2, already for genus 2, and for basically L bigger than 17, we cannot compute the division polynomials, the ELF division polynomial. Okay, so open problem is to compute ELF division polynomials. So I could get into this a little bit more if I have time, what this actually means, these polynomials in a sense. They aren't really polynomials. What they are is they are they can be computed via resultants, but what you're actually looking for is generators of certain ideals.
So you don't mean Cantor's division polynomial for just an x, y pair, you mean the ideal.
Right, so there's a terminology problem in this area, which is that division polynomials for elliptic curves are often thought to be those polynomials whose roots are the L torsion points. Whereas Cantor's division polynomials are those polynomials which tell you the Rth multiple of a point, actually of a divisor class of a certain type on the Jacobian. And so to use Cantor's division polynomials to get what we would call the analog of the elliptic curve division polynomials, we have to solve a system of equations which involves either using Gribner bases or doing resultant computations or whatever. And so what happens is that the degrees of the polynomials, which start out being L squared, and then you start taking resultants of these things, the degrees blow up. And so, unfortunately, supposedly still polynomial. And so, actually, so the record that I have seen in print is L equals 17, but I think Gaudry also said that he had done L equals 23.
Do you know how big a P you can do in that case?
Well, that's a good question. So he was working with, so this is the state of the art, the best implementation of this is Gaudry with, there was a paper Harley Gaudry, and then there's a paper Gaudry-Shost. And I'm not sure if the implementation is due to Gaudry or to all three of them or what, but he was dealing with P of size 2 to the 80. However, even dealing with like P of like 2 or 3 digits this summer with David Freeman, the polynomials for L equals 17 were actually never computed by Magnum. Magnum just completely died trying to do this.
Is there an advantage
so even if
more
even
P
if the P is small, I'm sorry.
Is there an advantage of working more P? Do you gain anything? I mean, you can put them in characters too.
Well. So I mean, just that your cost per field operation is just smaller, but even so, it didn't.
But how big do the coefficients go?
The coefficients of what?
So if you talk about the 17 division polynomial over Q,
you mean with generic coefficients?
With generic coefficients, if the coefficients don't go beyond 2 to the 8, is that what you wrote on the board? Then there's no point in reducing more.
Yeah, so the coefficients, I don't remember how big they are.
But I think that would be much worse because you've got big polynomials in the generic coefficients. You probably have something like L
okay, so let me.
So when you say they're computing the division polynomials, you mean for a specific curve with given coefficients, not generically?
Right, no, I mean a specific curve. Okay, so let me get on to the next point. Oh, one last point. Okay.
I'm not sure what I may have misinterpreted the answer. Was this to say that Gaudry was sort of doing arithmetic by 2 to the 8, or does this mean that sort of using up to L equals 17, he's actually able to find
the number of points
for a P that big?
So for a P that big, mm-hmm. he's able to start using Pila's algorithm.
Right.
For L up to 17.
But
and
that's
for
not nearly enough to,
no.
to get.
And so then you just have to switch to the exponential algorithms. And their record for point counting for a curve of cryptographic size, the most recent publication was 2004, is 1 week for counting the number of points on a curve of this size. It's basically using baby step, giant step. It uses L up to 17, uses the PILA, and then it quits and goes over the baby step. Okay, so I guess the point of all of this up to this point is that we have the following kind of situation, which is that if you start with a curve over a finite field, Fp of large characteristic, the reason I say large characteristic is that Kiran Kedlaya introduced point counting algorithms based on totally different ideas that work well when p is small. So you could take a large power of a small prime, and the Kedlaya-type algorithms will work well. So in genus 2, the record that I've seen for p, for those point counting algorithms to work well, is roughly p equals 251. That's the largest prime to which I've seen. So when you've got a prime of cryptographic size, we can't use those types of algorithms. These types of algorithms are exponential, and so we don't have good point counting. So if you pick a curve and you want to know if it's good for cryptography, you will have a hard time figuring out how many points it has on its Jacobian. But so suppose you, if you knew the number of points on the Jacobian, what I was kind of trying to convince you of up here is that that is the same as knowing the action of Frobenius, which is the same as knowing these pi's, which actually satisfy a characteristic polynomial which is a quartic. So you're probably used to the elliptic curve case where your Frobenius satisfies a quadratic equation, and you think of it as being an algebraic number defining an imaginary quadratic field. Here, we have that the number of points, knowing the number of points is like knowing the algebraic integer which satisfies the characteristic polynomial Frobenius, which defines a quartic field, which I'm going to call K throughout this talk. Okay, so the point of this talk is to say that we actually have algorithms for starting with the number of points, or equivalently starting with the field K, the quartic field, and then and going backwards and constructing a curve. Now, let me put a caveat in here. They're not very good algorithms in the sense that we're very restricted for which k we can actually make them work. If you give some large k with humongous discriminant, it's the same as in the elliptic curve case. We can't make the algorithms work. We really need these k to be have nice properties and be small in some sense. And understanding exactly what small means is also part of the open problem that I'm proposing here. Okay, so here's the idea of how these algorithms are supposed to work, is that you start with the K, and you go backwards, and you try to compute what are called the invariants of the curve. And the invariants, I'm going to call, I'm going to put another little thing in here, which is the Jacobian of the curve. There's the curve, and then there's its Jacobian. And so from the equation of a curve, we have something which we could call the Igusa, Clebsch, Bolsa, or maybe I should say Bolsa, Clebsch invariants. And the reason that I put two arrows here is that just like in the elliptic curve case, there's two ways to define the invariants. If you start with the equation of the curve, you can compute the invariants directly from the roots of this polynomial f, or from the coefficients of this polynomial. Just like if I give you an elliptic curve y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, then you tell me the j invariant is whatever, 1728 a squared something b cubed, blah, blah, whatever. If I start with a genus 2 curve, you can write down the invariants. Okay, but that's not very helpful if you don't know what the genus 2 curve is, right? Okay, so here's another way to define invariants. Just like in the elliptic curve case, you also have that if you've given me the elliptic curve in the form C mod a lattice, if you take if that lattice is generated by 1 and tau is a complex number, then I can also give you the j invariant of that curve by evaluating the modulus function j at tau. So, and j has a nice Q-series expansion, so I can actually evaluate J up to some amount of precision, and I'll get the J invariance of the curve. So the point here is that starting with, if you have a description, now this is not a description that exists over finite fields, but if you have a description of the Jacobian as a complex torus, so it's C2 model lattice with a Riemann form on it, which defines a polarization, you can associate to that a period matrix, which is, it basically represents this Jacobian as a point in the Ziegle upper half plane. And you can evaluate Ziegle modular functions at that CM point and get invariants that are associated to this abelian variety. And I'm going to call those throughout this the modular invariants, just like the J, the value of the J function is the modular J invariant for an elliptic curve. Okay, so we have, now I've just said two different kinds of invariants, modular invariants and the invariants here, which are basically invariants of a binary sextic. And what happened, this is actually very classical, in the 1880s, Bolsa related these two. So that's very convenient because that means that we can compute the invariants in either way and then very conveniently switch over to the other description to go back to the equation of the curve. And for that, we use an algorithm of Mestre, which allows you, and some extensions by Cardona and Clare, which allow you to, starting from the invariance of a curve, reconstruct the equation of the curve. Okay, so having made this diagram that we'll refer to kind of for the rest of the talk, once again, the idea is that we want to be able to start with a quartic number field, a CM field, and go over here, compute the invariance of the curve, and then use Mestre's algorithm to go back up to be able to produce the curve with that number of points. When we say that this is called actually the CM method, so you might say, why is it called the CM method? CM stands for complex multiplication, and these quartic fields are what are called quartic CM fields. They are imaginary quadratic extensions of a totally real field. The totally real field is no surprise here. It's it's just Q adjoin pi plus pi bar, and this is in a real quadratic field, and this is called a quartic CM field. And for our purposes, we want to make several assumptions under which we can actually do this. First of all, we want to be starting with an abelian variety which is ordinary. We're not going to deal with supersingular case here at all. So we just make certain assumptions on these numbers of points up here. I didn't actually write it explicitly, but you just have to assume something's prime to P. And that will make this ordinary. We also want to assume for cryptography, we would like a simple Jacobian, meaning it's not the product of two elliptic curves. So we do not want to start with a field K, which is actually just the composite of two imaginary quadratic fields. And so we're going to call those fields primitive. Okay, so throughout this, all of these algorithms work for primitive quartic CM fields. And an additional assumption for these algorithms to work is that K0 has class number 1. So the real quadratic field has class number 1. So under all of those assumptions, which I'm not going to write down right now, just a little bit of history of these algorithms. This was first implemented by a student of Gerhard Frey, Anna Monika Spalek, if I pronounced that right, and thesis around 94. And then you also had a student of Stark, von Wanelin, who implemented this for genus 2 curves, actually with CM that are defined over Q in 99. And Fernando Rodriguez Villegas, and then also, Villegas, and also Annegret Weng, another student of Frey. So this is roughly 2001, and I did an implementation. with Henry Cohen at Microsoft around the same time. So we've had a lot of implementations of this algorithm, and they all struggle from the same problem. So let me try to say very briefly kind of what the algorithm is and what the computational problem is. If we write down, I didn't actually give you the formulas for these invariants, but they're Ziegle modular functions, and so just like the J function, you can take them and you can evaluate them on a period matrix up to a certain amount of precision. That's the strategy of the algorithm. But the problem is that this is starting thinking of your curve as being having CM and being defined over some large number field. It's actually known to be defined, in this case, over the Hilbert class field of the reflex of this field K. So it could be a very large degree number field. And what you're trying to do is to recognize the invariants as algebraic integers. And all you get when you evaluate a Ziegle modular function at a period matrix is some floating point approximation. And so just like in the elliptic curve case, your job is how are we going to recognize this as an algebraic number? What's the minimal polynomial of this thing? And so the real problem here is that in order to recognize this number, what you end up doing is computing it and all of its conjugates and then forming the minimal polynomial and trying to recognize the coefficients. So now when you do this for elliptic curves, you're really in luck because this minimal polynomial actually miraculously has coefficients in Z. And so all you have to do is recognize integers. So if you get close enough, you can kind of round the thing off and you know that it's an integer. And in this case, the underlying problem in this whole algorithm is that the coefficients of this minimal polynomial are now in Q. They're rational numbers. And now you need to use some kind of continued fraction algorithm just to try to recognize these coefficients. So to make a long story short, the algorithm, you know, starts with, this uses the main theory of complex multiplication, and it runs through all the ideal classes of K to trying to get all the conjugates of these algebraic numbers. But actually, ideal classes have to be taken in combination with the polarization and a CM type. And I'm hiding all the details here that you have to figure out representatives for isomorphism classes of the abelian varieties that you get by making these three choices. So you do those, you get representatives for these things.
Is that the only step where you're using you were saying that you're assuming the HK0 is 1?
Yes, exactly. We want to have nice representatives for these ideal classes. We basically want one generator for the ideal over the ring of integers of K0. And the representatives for this were worked out by Schmalek. And so then what you want to do is that you evaluate the Ziegle modular functions to get these roots. Let's call them J sub I. There's three invariants. I didn't say that, but three absolute invariants. Three Ziegle modular functions, and you evaluate these at these representatives. Let's call them, by abusive notation, let's call the representatives A for the ideal class. And then you want to form this minimal polynomial, Hi of X, which is going to be the product over the representatives of X minus Ji of A. And then what you do is you have this is now a polynomial in Q of X, and you try to recognize the coefficients of this polynomial as elements of Q. When you first do this, you just have them as floating point integers, and then you try to recognize. So recognize the coefficients. So in practice, what happens is that you need a vast amount of precision to recognize these things. that you fail, and you can't recognize them. So then what you do is you go back and you start from the beginning again, and you start evaluating with more precision. And then you do this again until you finally succeed. And this is a total mystery when you're going to succeed, and it's completely unacceptable situation. So this was the problem roughly 5 years ago. It's basically the problem that I wanted to address in this talk. So there's kind of two solutions or two ideas. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about what these, essentially how big the denominators of these coefficients are. The denominators arise, so P divides the denominator of the coefficients of HI. If the curve actually, it was defined over a number field, it had CM by K. And then when you went and you tried to reduce at this prime P, what happened was that its Jacobian, it had a Jacobian which is an abelian surface, its Jacobian became a product of two elliptic curves with the product polarization. Okay, so this is a very nice geometric condition. In fact, in the moduli space, this is defined by the divisor of a certain function, which is often called chi 10 or delta or something like that. So this is the condition of the Jacobian is actually a product of elliptic curves mod p with the product polarization, which means it's not a Jacobian. It's a product of abelian varieties, but it's not a Jacobian itself. Okay, so this is actually a geometric question that you can study. And just to give you an example, computationally, what this kind of thing looked like. So, like, this was 2001. I'm sure it would go faster now, but 1 week of computation on a PC, starting with a very reasonable size quartic CM field, which was Q adjoin, let me see what the exact, Q adjoin I times the square root of 25 plus 2 root 133. This is something that had class number 4, not too large. The denominators for the first one for this thing were, the denominators were 7 to the 48 times 11 to the 72 times 19 to the 24 times 23 to the 12, 83 to the 12, 89 to the 12, 167 to the 12. Okay, so when you're just looking for a random rational number and you get something whose denominator factor is like this, you think there might be something special going on. And so, indeed, at the time, this reminded me very much of the factorization formulas that we see in Gros-Saguier, and we also had these primes are very special primes. The relative discriminant of this field is actually 93, and if you look, these primes are of a very nice special form, actually. They divide the relative discriminant minus the square, or something like that, small multiple of it. And so, they looked like they divide the relative discriminant minus the square. They actually divide the discriminant minus the square. And this was the first example where I found a prime which was actually bigger than the relative discriminant here. Okay, so there's some hint that there's something special going on here. And so I conjectured that the primes appearing in this denominator should be bounded by the discriminant of K. And in fact, I later found also that it was already known conditions on the decomposition of these primes in K. was in a paper from 97 of Eyal Gorin that, I mean, these have to be supersingular primes, and supersingular primes have a certain decomposition in K. So it's only primes of a certain form that could even appear here at all. Okay, so I was lucky enough to find out at that time that from Dick Gross that Eyal Gorin was interested actually in this very same question for a totally different reason, which was that he had constructed with de Chalit analogs of the elliptic units. Elliptic units were abelian units that were constructed to realize part of the Stark conjectures program to generate abelian extensions of imaginary quadratic fields. And the Gorin de Chalit unit, or let's call them S units, were a generalization of this. With it, basically, they're values of legal modular forms where the denominators are the same denominators as the ones that we're using here for the invariants. So they have the same question, what is this set S? For which primes, what primes can you have appearing in these denominators? So kind of the end, or close to the end of this story, is that Eyal Gorin and I were able to prove using geometric methods in 04 that if P divides the denominators, then P is less than something which is not exactly the discriminant, but it's close to the discriminant. So if the CM field K is Q adjoined I square root of A plus root D, which is not a unique representation for this field, then P is less than, or let me write it this way, or I'll just write 64 D squared A squared. If you notice, the discriminant here should be D squared times the relative discriminant, which is the norm of this thing. So D squared times A squared minus B squared D. So this discriminant is actually smaller than what we've proved. So originally I conjectured that the prime should be bounded by this discriminant. What we know is that they're bounded by something slightly larger than the discriminant. And what we think, based on experimental evidence, is that they're bounded by something even smaller, although not the relative discriminant, as this example shows. The relative discriminant is 91 here. Okay, so the next kind of advance in the story is that, I should write the names here, Brunier and Yang in a paper this year in Invenciones proved that there is a kind of a Gross-Sagué type factorization formula in this case, although they're not able to separate the numerators from the denominators because their techniques are very different. And so conjecturally, based on their Gross-Sagué formula for the quotient of these legal modular forms, they conjecture that these primes should actually, I'm going to call this D0, that these primes should be bounded by D times D0. So instead of D squared D0, they conjecture D times D0. And they also show, Tong Haiyang has shown that both this refined conjecture, well, my original conjecture and this refined conjecture would follow from a conjecture of Colmes in this area. So, and it's related to basically all the types of abelian varieties. Okay, so just to show you that this very computational question leads you into kind of a lot of interesting mathematics, and there's lots of open problems here. I think it's a very interesting area that's related to cryptography that has still a lot of work to be done in it. Okay, so, but back to this computational question, do we have any improvement now? Can we now actually start with these algorithms and predict how much precision we need? Okay, so there's still kind of two ingredients missing. What we've said here is that we now know how big these primes can be. Okay, so you might be looking suspiciously at these powers here, which seem rather large. they also all seem to be a multiple of 6, which is because for this particular invariant, this Ziegle modular form was appearing to the power 6 in the denominator. But anyway, in fact, as an extension of our methods, Gorin has also given a deformation theory argument to extend our proof to bound the powers that appear. And finally, what we would like to know in order to actually turn this back into a bound on the amount of precision we need, we would actually like to know how large are these complex numbers, the values of these Ziegle modular functions. So in joint work with David Freeman, which is actually work in progress, we are analyzing the size of the Ziegle modular functions, size of these, the total size. So the total size in absolute value plus an absolute bound on the denominators allows you to figure out a bound on the precision. Okay, so that's kind of the state of the art. However, I mean, just so as you can see here, first of all, this bound could still be improved. Plus, not all primes that could appear here based on their splitting behavior and their size do appear. So those are, if they actually appear, they're primes that we call evil primes. So just studying which primes actually do appear is a whole endeavor in itself. And then improving the bound on the powers, all of these things will help us to get an algorithm that runs better in this case. I mean, I think the absolute record for which one of these algorithms has been implemented is something like class number 12 by Annegret Wang. So, I mean, we haven't advanced very far with these algorithms yet. Okay, so the second thing that I wanted to talk about is that there's another algorithm which you could use to to address this issue of generating curves with CM by a particular field. And this is, I'm going to talk about joint work with Kirsten Eisentrager. And again, this is an analogy with something that we had done in the elliptic curve case, which is to decide that instead of trying to compute this minimal polynomial as something in characteristic zero with coefficients in Q, that we could actually try to compute the minimal polynomial modulo lots of small primes and then use the Chinese remainder theorem and put this together to get the minimal polynomial modulo a prime that we wanted. So this is the, you know, the CRT method, Chinese remainder theorem method for genus 2, and this is joint with Kirsten Eisentrager.
So okay. Also relying on bounds for the denominators?
Yep.
Okay.
Also relying. And so the idea here is that first what we do is to prove a theorem which says that if you take P to be in a certain set S, and here, so K, the input for this algorithm is, again, it's just like that bottom arrow of that triangle. The input is a field K, and the output is supposed to be the minimal polynomial of the invariance, except for now, I mean, for constructing the curve, you only need this minimal polynomial modulo P, the prime where you eventually want the curve. And so what the CM algorithm does is it constructs this minimal polynomial with coefficients in Q and then reduces mod P. And what the CRT method does is it tries to compute the minimal polynomial modulo lots of small primes, which I'll call PI, and then tries to reconstruct the minimal polynomial modulo, the larger prime, using the explicit Chinese remainder? Okay, so but it's very important to work with the right set of primes. So let S be the set of primes P such that P splits completely in K, and not introduced this notation yet, but since I'm somewhat short on time, I'm not going to introduce it now either, into principal ideals in K star, where K star is the reflex field. So just for the sake of time, if K is actually a Galois cyclic extension, which is one of the two possibilities, I'm going to cheat. K star is the same as K. So you can think of the condition as just being that P splits completely in K. And so if a P is a prime in S, then the Igusa class polynomials, Hi of X for I equal 1, 2, 3, mod P, are the same as the polynomial that you get by going over all the curves over the field FP that are, oops, in a set which I'll call TP. And TP are the FP bar isomorphism classes of genus 2 curves over FP with the endomorphism ring of the genus 2 curve equal to endomorphism ring of the Jacobian of the genus 2 curve, sorry, equal to the ring of integers in the quartic field. Okay. So, you can pick any representative you want. There's a reason these are called invariants. They have the same value on any of the members of the FP bar isomorphism class. And so this theorem gives you an alternate way to compute these polynomials mod P. So just as in the elliptic curve case, what you can now do is you can start with small primes. Okay, so now, maybe let's call these elements PI. These are small primes PI, which are different from the eventual large prime P for which we want the algorithm to succeed. Okay, so for small primes, this may seem counterintuitive, but what you can actually do is PI, you can actually look for the curves over FP with the right isogeny class simply by the most efficient way is to just generate a random, generate a curve from its invariance and generate a random point on the Jacobian and raise it to the group order that the group is supposed to have if it's in the right isogeny class. So I guess what I didn't say here is that being a member of this TPI is really a twofold condition. First of all, it means you have to be in the right isogeny class, and second of all, it means that you have to have the right endomorphism ring. So the first thing you do is check that it's in the right isogeny class, and that you can do by checking the number of points on the curve and its extension, or the number of points on the Jacobian. But as a first elimination, you can just take a random point and raise it to that group order. And if it's not killed, then you know it can't have that number of points. So you can go on to the next method. So you sieve through and you find the possible triples of the Igusa invariants this way. And then the second step is to compute whether it actually has the right endomorphism ring. So how many more minutes do I have? 2 minutes? Okay, so let me just say that to implement this algorithm, as you can see from what I just said, one of the main steps is, so computing the endomorphism ring. Over FP, and here P is really small. P is, and the reason we are using P small is that we're actually using that we know the zeta function. Okay, so, and this is joint work with David Freeman, and let me just end with kind of an example of what this work is able to do. So, David did a full implementation of the Chinese remainder theorem algorithm, including the computation of endomorphism rings. And I think it's fair to say that before this implementation, we really didn't know what was going to be the bottleneck for this algorithm. And it was natural to think that computing the endomorphism rings would actually be the bottleneck, because it's really easy to take the invariance and generate the curve and check if a curve has the right order. But so I would say kind of the surprising thing that came out of the work with David is that actually we were able to come up with probabilistic algorithms for computing the endomorphism ring, and what ends up being the bottleneck is just going through the p-cubed invariance. And partly that's a bottleneck because we're using Magnus' implementation of hyperelliptic curve to whatever it is from Igusa Klapsch or something. So as an example, here's the data for a small part axiom field, so small in the sense of discriminant and class number one, and fairly small discriminant, as you can see. Okay, so to compute the minimal polynomials modulo enough small primes to be able to recover them either with coefficients in Q or modulo another large prime, you have to compute them for the primes 29, 53, 61, 79, 107, 113, 131, 139, 157, and 191. So pretty small primes. And just as an example, the largest prime for which we actually have to do endomorphism ring computations is for p equal 157. And it actually takes 50 minutes just using magma to generate the p-cubed curves from their invariance and check if they are in the right isogeny class just by raising a point to a random power. So to me, this seems like no way should this take this amount of time, but that's what it takes in magma. And it actually takes, so 243 curves are left out of the p-cubed curves that you start with. And to sieve through those to get the one which has the right endomorphism ring takes 26.9 seconds. Okay, and this data is representative of all the small examples that we looked at. Okay, so I've stated a bunch of open problems kind of throughout the talk. So I think I've kind of covered all of the open things I wanted to say. So I'll end there. Thank you.